Yeah.
If he says no.
All right.
All right, hit the button.
Hey, sport, you race four-wheelers?
It'd be a lot cooler if you did.
All right, welcome back, everyone, to episode 29 of the Thumb Throttle Podcast. I'm your co-host, Colton Yankovich.
I am your host, John Yankovich. That's probably the most you're going to hear Colton talk all night. And we got a special deal tonight. We have another co-host, none other than our very own second highest grossing download podcast star, Devin Masters. What's up, Devin?
Not a whole lot, just enjoying the night.
Yeah, we were you text me and was like, hey man, you gonna do a podcast this week? And I'm like, well, usually this is the week we take off because I'm on afternoons, and it just lined up. I'm like, hey, what the hell, why not? And then I thought, well, it'd probably be even cooler if you were just kind of like part of the show instead of just like a call-in guest. So that way there you can add to whatever you want and we can just go from there. Because other than Colton making a bunch of weird noises with all the equipment and everything else.
I had to fix my headphones.
So, yeah, just
blaming it on the headphones.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He'll blame it on everything he has a chance to blame it on.
I got you. So, how do you guys feel about all the races being canceled this week?
You know what? I'm not a big fan of blood races and definitely not a big fan of cleaning up after them. So, or pulling into a mud race when the field's muddy and flooded and everything else. So I'm on board with all the rescheduling. How about you?
I mean, I'm not too upset about it. I don't like having to clean up all the mud after I'm done racing. And everybody knows that it's just after a while of running a mud race, you get not tired, but like, it's just miserable, right?
Yeah.
So, plus it was going to be colder. We started getting used to that like 60-some, 70-degree weather. And then it's like, oh, wait, I'm going to snow again.
Right.
So, I'm not too upset about it. But it would have been nice to get some seat time. But
yeah, that's been hard to get here recently.
Yeah. Yeah, so the last time I rode my four-wheeler was the last New East Coast race, and I didn't get to ride very long there. So
that
I'm doing great.
Well, it seems like the bad luck and the mechanicals have been following you, but at least it's not something that was brand specific this time. I mean, this could have happened to anything. What you stripped out the Heim joint on your A arm, right?
Yeah. So the Walsh A arms, you don't have adjustable ball joints. So the ball joints are set in one specific place, and then you have the two Heim joints on the uppers. So the bottom doesn't adjust at all. It has no ball joint adjustment or anything. Top doesn't have any ball joint adjustment. And then you just had the two Heim joints so you can adjust the camber on the outside of the tire.
Yeah.
And I've never had one do that before. So I'm not sure. I mean, it might have just been because they were getting some age on them. I think I bought those A-arms in like 2017 or 18. So it's not like I haven't got my use out of them. It's just I never thought in a million years that the – A-arm would strip out before the Heim joint had problems. So
it's kind of like Murphy's Law, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of caught me off guard. I was riding with Ronnie, so I didn't feel like I was riding bad. And then I could feel something weird going on. Like not very far after beginning the race, I could feel something weird in the front end of the bike. And then I was running with Ronnie and we were carrying a pretty decent pace. And then everything just started getting worse. And then by the end of the lap, probably 2 miles from the finish on the second lap, the Heim joint came completely out as I was going into an off camber left-handed turn. So all of the pressure was on the right side where the Heim joint came out, and it just like tried to yank the handlebars out of my hands. And at that point I didn't know what was wrong. So pulled over, I was checking for like wheel bearing play or it's like some ball joint play or something like that. And when I grabbed a hold of the tire, the whole AR moved, and I was like, oh yeah, that's not good.
Wasn't so, expecting it to come from there.
Yeah. I was expecting something like out on the end, which, I mean, if it was out on the end, like ball joint or something like that, I probably would have ran it anyways.
Yeah.
But since the A-arm was no longer attached to the four-wheeler on one point. Yeah. So, because I've finished races before with no wheel bearings in my tire. I just leaned further to the other side of the bike on the back of it so the front end would stay light on that side.
Yeah, that's kind of like we do at the, mine. Like when something breaks, you just keep running it because eventually you're going to have to fix it anyways. It's just how much are you going to have to fix it? So
yeah. I mean, I've done some, I guess, pretty sketchy stuff. Most of the time I try to finish if any way possible. I had a pivot bolt break once, so like the end of the nut. Yeah. And or the end of the bolt broke off and the nut came off. So like I didn't have the whole bolt. But the bolt was trying to slide out. So the whole time I was racing is that bolt would come out. I'd just take my foot and kick it. Yeah. And everybody'd be like, what was you doing out there? I was just kicking the bolt back in. Started a race once with tie wire and heavy duty zip ties around my ball joint on my knuckle. So the ball joint had play in it and we took a pipe and we hit it. So that way it would try to get rid of some of the play, but we put tie wire and heavy duty zip ties around the ball joint to catch it just in case it would fly apart. So that way, if it did come apart, it wouldn't dig into the dirt.
Yeah.
Safety and flip me. Yeah. So, I mean, safety is priority, obviously,
for
what we're doing. Just because it doesn't look that great doesn't mean that it can't perform. So,
it doesn't have to look OEM in order to work properly.
Yeah, I mean, when you do stuff like that, it adds a little bit of horsepower too. So makes the bikes run a little bit better. Yeah,
plus like 5 horsepower.
I love how you can get Colton to chime in anytime you talk about horsepower on meaningless things.
I mean, that's where it comes from, right?
Yeah,
that's how you cut down the speed on the. You cut down lap times that way. Like it's very beneficial.
Oh,
it's good for your health too.
Yeah, absolutely. like any sticker is worth at least a quarter horsepower.
No, like try two whole horsepower, bud. That's why graphics are key.
Well, I was going to say, if you put a graphics kit on, that's like 10 to 15.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like adding a turbo.
Yeah.
Well, it's like the look pro go slow. Slogan.
Hey, that is my theme right there. I am 100% look pro, go slow. I'm perfect.
As long as it looks, you can win the race without even taking off the starting line if you look like you can run fast. So
that's how I've won most of my races, albeit in my
one race, and it was a fair race.
Hey, fair races count. Those are the most sketchy, dangerous, physically
then
demanding.
I'm a national champion, bud.
You won one too.
No.
How many did you win? Oh yes. Yeah,
so I've won like three.
Three fair races.
Yeah.
Are you sure about
on all my bikes, yeah.
I don't know. We'll have to go back to the archives for that one. I think I'm calling a little bit of truth stretch in there.
Nope, that
100%
true. But yeah, I'm not tore up about the races being canceled. I know, or not canceled, but postponed. I know Richie came out and had his, he did a live, cause they were racing where down on Mountaintop, I believe, for the, Mideast Hair Scrambles or Mountain State. I'm sorry. And,
yeah, they were running, Switchback Mountain this week, okay. Which is like up around, Table Rock.
Mm-hmm.
So you familiar with like Red House?
No.
All right. Well, if you, all right, if you go past the Buckwheat Racetrack, right, or CJ right. is what we call it for the locals,
yeah.
and you hit Route 50, and you just follow 50 all the way up into Maryland.
Okay.
You just follow 50 until you get to Table Rock. I can't remember if it's Table Rock Tavern or Table Rock Bar, but you turn in, and it's like right down the road from the bar there. We actually used to race on a property closer to the main road than what that one is. That track is actually the one where my wheel bearing blew out and I finished the race with just leaning to the other side and hoping that my tire didn't fall off.
So,
but
when you go down,
it's right in that area.
When you go down to 50, do you make the left? Like you're going to, what is that? Not C and J, but C and, was it C and H or whatever?
Yeah, C and H.
Is it C and H?
It's C and H.
Cause I remember they had that one of the triple crowns there last year for New East Coast.
Yeah, the new property that we ran for the buddy races.
Yeah, that one.
Yep.
Up on top
of the hill. Yeah, you turn left like you're going towards it, and okay. then you just keep driving.
Oh, all
right. And then about 40 minutes or so from there, you'll be there. It might not be exactly that long, but it feels like it takes forever because the road's windy and twisty and it seems like it takes forever. Yeah. But you can also go through you can go through Oakland too and get there.
So Oakland. All the way yep. over on the West Coast?
No. Oakland, Maryland. that would be pretty crazy. Drive out there and race out west.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a different kind of racing there. There's not many trees. It's a lot of sand. Way too fast paced for me. I like the technical stuff because it gives me an excuse to not have to live on that ragged edge of death for 2 hours.
That's true. I was excited to run the state line track this weekend because I feel like it's typically one of my better tracks that mm-hmm. I ride. But also at the same time with the rain and stuff that we had, that track gets like gnarly sick. So I'm not too mad about not racing there in the wet, but like some of those faster sections,
yeah.
you'll find yourself throwing some donuts sometimes. But that track is pretty sweet.
I do like that track. I'm trying to think. I raced there.
Didn't I win there last year?
No, you didn't win there last year.
Yes, I did.
No, you didn't.
No, I didn't. I got second. You've just
been laying claim to all these wins. Like anytime somebody mentions a race, yeah, I won there. You did? Oh, no, maybe I didn't. Maybe it wasn't there. But
it's a thought that counts, buddy. You got to think like you win every race. And then when someone calls you on it.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah, pretty much. that carries more weight if you do it before the race, not after the race.
That's true.
You're funny.
You got to start somewhere.
Yeah, I guess it's true. You got to refine the process. I did run that track last year. So, I mean, I didn't light the world on fire, but I mean, they are rescheduling it. So that's good. We'll get another shot there.
When is it rescheduled to?
June 29th, I believe 29th and 30th for the two wheel portion of this sport.
Yeah. I believe it's, the weekend after Snowshoe.
Yes. So. Yes, wow. Absolutely. So back-to-back again. We missed one back-to-back, and we'll just kick it on down the road. But
yeah.
I forget what I was going to say about you said something, and then we talked about – I was just going to say stuff like, you know, I was back and forth like kind of stressing out about, well, do we run big tires this time? Because we didn't run big tires at – the first one, and I don't know that it hurt him, but it might have helped him. And then with all the rain we had this week leading up to it, I was seriously thinking about putting the big tires on there because we run the smaller tires, the 1810s.
More horsepower.
And I thought, man, I got a new set of big tires that we can throw on there. And I didn't want to put my tire, even though it would gave me a great excuse not to have to race. I don't know that I wanted to put those tires on there because they got the tire blocks in it. And I think that's just a little bit too much weight for that bike.
Yeah, the tire blocks definitely would make it heavy. I think on that track, even with all the rain and stuff, you probably would be fine running the small tires because
really
most of that property has like a good base to it.
Uh-huh.
Not like there's a couple spots that has some rocks, but like there's not a lot of rocks. It's just like it's just solid ground.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. You probably would have been fine with the small tires, but obviously, anytime it rains as much as what it has, and you know, being spring, it's already soft anyways in most places. It's never a bad idea to consider it. Typically, I once you get to the 450s, like I only have 20-inch tires. I don't have big tire setups. So, like even the snowshoe and stuff, I just run my typical 21-20 setup, and it is what it is.
That's what I was going to ask you, if you ever ran the different setup, and if you did, was it that much of a difference getting used to that larger tire on there? But since you never did.
So I haven't.
Oh.
most people do. It's not in the budget to buy big tires that sit around for special occasions. So. Right. I don't have enough money laying around to be like, you know what, I'm going to go buy some tires, and then I'm going to put tire balls or tire blocks in them, and then they're going to sit there, and I'm going to run them like a couple times a year or something like that.
If that.
Yeah, which, don't get me wrong, I'm sure there probably is some benefits to it, but even with the small tires, you can adjust where you're riding on the track to make up for the difference on it.
Yeah, I would think so.
So it's not a deal ender. If I was going to run big tires, there would be a lot more process than just, hey, I'm going to throw these tires on there. Like, we would figure out what the gearing ratio and stuff needs to be.
And that's where I started getting a little bit anxious, because it was like, it's not just throwing the bigger tires on, because now we're geared for the smaller tires. And then if you gear up, now guess what? I got to put a longer chain on. So it was like, man, when they said they're going to postpone, it was just like a wave of relief came over me. Like, I didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of people don't consider that either. Like, there's a lot of people out there that'll put big tires on and not change anything.
Mm-hmm.
Which, don't get me wrong, you can get by with. But I'm just in the mindset of, if I'm going to put bigger tires on, then I want the gearing to be able to, I want my bike to run the same.
Right.
So even though I'm putting the bigger tires on, and I know that they're going to be a little bit heavier, so it's not going to be exactly the same, but I want to try to keep that power curve as close as possible. So then you change sprockets. And
right.
Sometimes you're looking at changing the chain, depending on how much you have to actually change the gearing and stuff like that. So, again, it's not just hey, let me buy these tires and going to sit around, I'm going to run them. It's, okay, well, I want to make sure I have the gearing laying around that I need. I want to make sure that I have the tires ready, stuff like that. So if I just don't have it, I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was Hunter once that said something like, they asked him like, you know, what's your bike feel like? Or he's like, I honestly could care less like what it feels like, as long as it's the same. Like, if it's bad and it's continuously bad, he's like, that's better than being good and then going to bad, or being bad and then going to good. He's like, because you know what you're expecting out of it the whole time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
If something sucks from the beginning, but it still sucks at the end,
yeah,
it's a lot easier to adjust for than, man, this thing is really good right now, and then as the race goes on, it starts being worse. Well, right. Now you're just continuously fighting everything the whole time.
Right.
Because one bump might not be the same as the next. So I could definitely see where that might be a good thing. Each their own, though, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
Some people might not notice.
Right, right.
So
I just think I overanalyze a lot of things. I tend to really put way more thought into it sometimes than what it really requires, and I think that kind of gets me in trouble because I'll be thinking about, you know, and in my mind I can justify it, but like you said, does it really even make a difference? I mean, like Colton, I think I could put him on something and never tell him anything, and
I would feel it.
You wouldn't.
Yes, I would. Yes, I would.
Oh, you would?
Yes.
So did you notice that I changed your front shocks at all?
You didn't.
How do you know I didn't?
Because I know you didn't, because it doesn't feel different.
Oh. Okay. You sticking with that answer?
I'm thinking about this conversation. He's definitely setting you up.
Yeah. I was just going to say, this sounds like a setup for something.
Well, I was just testing you because I mean,
you didn't.
You're right. I didn't. So if that's the case, then.
See?
No, if that's the case, now that I'm going to expect more feedback out of you whenever I do something.
Why did I do that?
Yeah. You lost this conversation as soon as you opened your mouth.
Yep.
So now when I say, hey, what's that feel like? And you're like, it feels good. So I'll be tricking you now. I might do something to your bike. I might not do something to your bike. So
great.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I'm one of the guys that when I was coming up, my dad was, I mean, he still helped me on stuff. But my dad would make adjustments to my bike. And I was the guy that was always like, don't even tell me what you did. I don't want to know. I don't care what you did. As long as the thing goes to the starting line, we're good. So my dad would make changes to my bike without me knowing, and I would never be able to tell. So I wasn't able to give feedback and stuff that great. It's like when you're watching Days of Thunder, right?
Yeah.
He starts asking him about putting a little bit of wedge in the car and stuff like that. And he's like, what does that even mean? That was me. I just knew how to get on it and ride it. And then when it came to setup and stuff, I didn't know. I didn't really care either. I liked racing. So I just hop on and race. But yeah, that was kind of our setup, is my dad would make changes and then I wouldn't know if anything was changed or not. And he'd be like, does the bike feel any different? And I'd be like, I don't know.
Well, I think that's a good thing too, because like sometimes with Colton, if I'll say something, like that'll get in his head. Like if I say like, hey, you know, I didn't get a chance to look at your sprocket. I think it might be, you know, just a little worn, not bad, but you know, it's been like since last year, I haven't really changed it. And then something will happen. He'll go off and he'll be like, you know, I just really think it was that sprocket. Like I think it was holding me back somehow.
So yeah, well, like I
can't trust you anymore. Cause you remember what happened to the Mountaineer?
The Mountaineer. Oh, you broke a chain.
Yeah. Because it was too loose. And I told you multiple times it was loose. And you're like, nah, it'll be fine.
I can't imagine me saying it would be fine if it's something that I could easily fix.
I said, look, doesn't that look loose? And you went, no, you'll be fine.
Well, then you have to be a bigger advocate for yourself if you believe it's loose.
I did.
I was like, you said, is that fine? And I must have said, allegedly, no, you'll be okay.
No, you did.
And then you were like, okay, I'm fine.
Whatever. But
I was really bad about it. If my dad would tell me he made an adjustment, I did exactly what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. I would come back and be like, this thing feels like crap, or like something's different. Something's off on the bike.
Yeah.
And I would just have every excuse in the book when I came back.
Why?
And all it was a mental thing, right? Like, yeah. I was just, he would tell me that he changed it. So then in my head, I'm like, oh man, this sucks.
Yeah.
And then I would come back and he would say, you know, well, it ain't my fault that you didn't do that great today or something like that. And I'd be like, well, that's fair. So I just got to the point where I said, listen, if you make a change to my bike, and it was usually when it came to suspension, you would adjust suspension and stuff, right? And you wouldn't, I wouldn't want to know, because if I did, and I do that exact thing where I'd be like, oh, it feels like crap now. It feels way worse than what it did or something like that. So I finally just got to the point where I said, listen, if you change anything on this four-wheeler, do not tell me about it.
Yeah.
Just make the change and then I'll go ride it. And that was kind of the system we had. He would change whatever he thought needed to be changed based on what feedback I would give him. And then I would just ride it. So as long as he didn't tell me about it, it didn't bother me. I would just get along with my day and I'd be good to go. So I could definitely see where that plays a game and definitely hurts people in the long run sometimes. But then as I got older, I started being more interested in, hey, what does this do? Or, you know,
yeah,
if I make this little adjustment here, is this going to save me a couple seconds in this section or something like that? And bike setup became a lot more important to me. So there's a lot of times my bikes look rough and I might not have every brand new part that I should have on the bike, but I still try to mechanically make sure that it's good, or at least as good as we can make it. And we try to make sure that it steers and handle, or like it'll handle and stop.
Yeah.
Sorry. So as long as it'll handle and as long as it'll stop, everything else I can adjust for.
And
so,
I've always tried to, like, I'm very interested in the mechanics of shocks and how shocks work and, you know, how that can make it better. So to me, still shocks are like black magic. And I tell Micah that. I'm like, Micah, I really don't even know what to ask you to help us with, because I don't know. And then asking Colton, like, I could turn his clickers all the way out. And he's like, yeah, no, it feels good. And I'm like, well, how does that feel good? Like, I don't know, but I can't imagine it feels the same. And like, I've always been trying to get him to kind of tell me, like, you know, does it feel good? Does it not feel good? Cause it's like, we get a set of shocks, we throw them on the bike. I mean, basically Micah builds them. He sets them for his weight, puts the clickers wherever he thinks they're good. And then, I mean, that's where we run them. And I know Micah's good, but I mean, that's like next level Jesus stuff to be able to set shocks up in a shop, throw them on a bike and you're good all year, which I think there should be some more to it, but maybe there's not. Maybe that is how it goes. I mean, I know you, the Axis shocks are, you know, very tunable and you can do a lot of things with them, but I just feel like we should do more with them than what we do. But then again, I think, well, the less he knows about it, maybe the better off we are, you know, and maybe it's just one of those things right now.
Whenever you get a chance, check your email.
Okay.
I sent you a little something.
All right.
It'll help you with your shocks.
Oh, okay. Cool.
So, Micah, I've tried to learn as much as I can from Micah, and I can definitely get what you're saying, because when he first started showing me stuff, like, everything was foreign, right? Like,
yeah.
I have no clue what I'm looking at. I have no clue what we're trying to achieve here, what the ideal setup looks like. He's got that shock dyno in his trailer that he tests all the shocks on and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I understand how a dyno works, but when it came to specifically shocks, okay, what am I looking at on the dyno here? Stuff like that. So, you know, he'll pull it up on the computer and he saves all the configurations and changes that he's made to the shocks and stuff like that. So he's really good at keeping a sheet of what he's done and things that we've done to make them better or worse. So that way we know where to go moving forward. But I've tried to learn as much as possible. And I just sent you an email with like his basic tuning guide, we'll call it. But it has like the adjustment terminology in there. So that way, when it's talking about something, it'll tell you exactly what it is. It's got troubleshooting tips. So like, it'll give you a example of a problem and then below it, it'll have solutions, right? And it'll say, adjust this, this, and this should help with the problem that you're having.
Yeah.
but it gives you a better understanding of kind of what you're tuning and what that is actually going to help you. So I think if you give that a look, that might be a good place, right? So
yeah, I'll definitely look in. I'll get into it more than just looking at it right now, because I need to actually focus on it. And right now I need to focus on the podcast. But yeah,
I was just making sure to let you know that I sent it over to you.
So, no, I already got it.
Cause it might be helpful.
Yeah. No. And so, that's like one of those things too. It's like, I think the question I've asked Micah more than any of them is, so the blue one does what and the black one does what? And it's like, I have so many things going through my head. It's like, that's probably like one of those things that should be like just common knowledge, but it's like, I'm so overwhelmed with everything and I'm trying to learn everything. It's like, I'm over stimulated with everything there is. And I know that we can do more with our shock setup and our suspension setup than what we do. I just don't know how to do it. Like we'll go up to the trailer and I'll ask Mike, I'm like, okay, can you take a look at these? And I kind of just feel like I'm wasting his time, because like, he'll ask Colton, he's like, do they feel good? And Colton's like, yeah. And Mike was like, well, all right then. I'm like, well, okay. So basically just came up here to just hang out at the trailer for a little bit and, you know, we'll just go now. But It's definitely one of those things I think that I would really like to learn more about, and more than just an understanding of it, but almost like a working knowledge of it too, as well.
Yeah. So like the biggest benefit I've gotten from it is the more that I learn about the shocks, the easier it is for Micah to adjust them. So even if I'm not the one exactly making the adjustments on them, which I can make some of the adjustments.
Right.
But the more I learn about the shock, the easier it is for me to tell Micah what he needs to fix.
Right.
Instead of, because like I used to do the same thing. I'd go up there and I'd be like, he's being adjusted. Well, what's it feel like? I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
I know it sucks. apart from that, I don't really know what like specifically to tell you to fix this. You know, here's my big problem. What do you do for that? Well, there's a bunch of things that can cause that. So as you learn, like, okay, this, it's doing it on this exact scenario. Okay, well, now we know that we can narrow that down to something that's more adjustable than just, yeah, it didn't work.
And I think a big thing, too, is knowing, like, what can be improved with a shock setup and what can't be. Like, you know, obviously you're not going to get any more power from a good shock setup, but you will be able to accelerate out of corners faster or be able to go through a certain section faster, or you might be able to do one or two other things. And I think that's another thing too, that I have a hard time with, because I don't know exactly what all can be improved by the shocks. You know what I mean? Like obviously bumps and shock absorbing, but I assume that there can be some things too that the average person doesn't really attribute to being able to the shock being able to help them with.
Hill climbs is a big one that really? People wouldn't necessarily think about.
Huh?
Yeah. I would. You ever been going up a hill and not have traction?
Yeah.
All right. You ever been going up a hill with good tires on and never had traction?
I don't know if I've had both of those instances at the same time.
Exactly.
Doesn't have to be at the same time, but what I run Maxxis, but as much as I love Maxxis, I've had problems before with bike setup where like it. And again, I'll run whatever tire. I don't really care. But like, for example, I've ran Maxxis for years.
Uh-huh.
And I've always ran that tire. And I've ran other tire brands and stuff, and I've tried other tires. I don't think I've tried the GB3s yet. I might have once. But I always end up back on the same tire because that's what I've set all of my stuff up for. So, like, my shock setup and everything is accounted for Max's tires on the bike, right? So it does make a difference if I set the bike up with different tires and stuff too. But the big thing there is rebound on the rear shock, right? So I always thought that, like, I always felt that sometimes my rebound would be too fast.
Uh-huh.
Which would attribute to me not having traction going up hills, right? And this is stuff that I've learned working with Micah, is I would go back to him and I'm like, dude, this thing, like, feels like I'm not going anywhere when I'm going uphill.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, your rebound might be too slow. So when you're hitting some of those bumps or rocks or stuff like that as you're going uphill, the bike is not digging for traction. So if your suspension is not right, sometimes you can have problems with hill climbs because your bike's not actually digging in the way it needs to for traction, which then attributes to you spinning and sometimes could lead to you getting stuck and stuff if you don't actually know what is happening to, like, try to move your body around to adjust for it.
So basically, but, like, what you're saying is, like, if you're going up there, instead of that, instead of the shock actually keeping the rear tire planted, it's actually trying to push itself away and then losing traction. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, exactly. So okay. One thing that I learned was that, like, your real fast guys, like your XC1 guys, top XC2 guys, stuff like that, their bikes don't look like they move very far when they're hitting bumps.
No,
right?
It doesn't.
So their bikes, yeah, they stay pretty flat, pretty yeah. planed out, right? They're actually running faster rebound. So I was always trying to slow my rebound down, thinking that it was too fast causing problems. But really, I was making it worse because it wasn't going fast enough. So speeding up the rebound and doing a little bit of work on the rear shock actually helped when it came to being able to get traction in the turns, when it came to getting traction to go up hills, stuff like that. But I brought up uphills because that's something that people typically don't think about when it comes to shock setup, other than the fact if it tries to, like, kick you real hard on a big bump going uphill, right? So uh-huh. you get kicked real hard going up a hill and you're like, oh man, it kicked me really hard on that bump there. When really there's, like, minute things that could be going on as you're trying to go up a hill and you're losing time because of it. So I just brought that example up because there's a lot of people that would never think of that being a problem or causing them issues. So yeah, next time you're going up a hill or something, maybe think about it and see if you think the bike feels a little bit weird, because if you're not really paying attention to something, it's hard to actually know if it's right. causing you a problem.
So in that instance, we would speed up the rebound, right?
And again, it could be, depending on how the shock is set up, it could possibly be too fast. But mm-hmm. like in the circumstance that I had, I was actually turning my stuff too slow, and then that was causing me problems. So I'm not saying it's impossible that you need to slow it down, but you'll be able to tell when you're doing it. Once I started paying attention to it after Micah kind of brought it up to me, I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Just because I started thinking about how the bike was working when I was going up or anything after that, I was kind of like paying attention a little bit more to it. But typically you're probably going to be speeding it up.
Yeah.
So,
and it all goes back to too, like, you don't know what you don't know. So if you don't know that, you know, you can even be helped by suspension in certain instances, I mean, you might just think, well, this is just the way it is. Maybe I need to get better. When in fact, if there is something that can help you, and then you can get better. But yeah, like all this stuff, like I love learning this stuff because I think the more information you have to a point can be very beneficial. I mean, there is a thing as having too much information because then you get overwhelmed. And if you're kind of somebody like me, like it's not just, okay, it's A, B, or C. It's A through Z, and everything's intertwined and everything's connected, and I end up driving myself crazy. But yeah, I've been trying to get Micah on here for a while, but just never been able to kind of like iron things out either. You know, he was all set to go and something happened, but I'd love to have him on here one day, and you know, maybe we'll kind of do the same thing and kind of like conference him in, because obviously you know more of the questions to ask and where to lead them than I would. And I know Micah's not a very, very talkative guy sometimes too, so it would be hard for me to kind of lead him into where I needed him to go with it without knowing how to do it.
So one thing I've learned with Micah too is that he's really smart, right?
Yeah.
So I try not to talk to him in a way where I seem like I'm super, super stupid when I'm asking a question, because I think sometimes when you ask something that's super stupid, he's really nice. So he's never going to be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. He'll try to explain it to you in a way that does make sense and help you understand. So I think it's cool that he's so smart, but he doesn't like downgrade you for not knowing what you're talking about.
Right.
But yeah, I try to at least get enough information so that when I ask him something, I don't completely sound like an idiot, because when he talks about stuff and he uses like the actual terminology of what he's trying to talk about and stuff like that, I don't want to be standing there with like a blank look on my face as if I am pretending to understand what he's saying. So again, that goes back to I started learning about shocks because it was making it easier for me to learn enough about it.
Right.
That I could tell him, and that it helped him be able to help me more. So
did you ever listen?
There's constantly things to do though.
Did you ever listen to like some of the old, or not old podcasts, but I think, On the Pipe had one, and I think even Pulp kind of did too. And they would talk about the pro circuit days and Bones, the shock guy that Mitch had working for him.
Yep.
That's like, I think Micah is the modern day Bones, like the shock guy that just knows how to do it all, is like shock god.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, he's a genius. I don't know this outside of working on shocks. I'm just saying, like, my experience working on shocks and stuff with him, he's a genius when it comes to that.
Yeah.
And as smart as he is with that, I assume he's pretty good at everything else that he does. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can only speak on things that I've worked with him on. And I will say that he's a genius when it comes to that. And he is... Again, he's really smart, but he's good at understanding, like, if I do go to him and say something and it's not exactly how he would say it, he's good at figuring out what I'm trying to get across.
Yeah.
But I try to do my best to at least get better at it. So, but he's the man.
And that's kind of like you were saying too, like, I want to learn more about it so that I can utilize Micah to the best of the ability that I can. You know, I don't want to be like, oh, Micah, it kind of feels a little stiff. Like, I want to be able to say, hey, it feels stiff coming out of such and such turn doing this or doing that, and be able to kind of get to that next level of help. And I in no way, shape, or form, I don't think it's because, like, he isn't willing to help. I just think it's to the point where it's like, hey, somebody can explain to me physics or how a nuclear bomb works, but it's kind of worthless to me because I don't know enough about it to put it into play. And I think that's kind of like what, like you were saying, like Micah does, like he will tell you exactly what it is that you need to know, but he's not going to tell you something that you're not going to be able to understand, and you're just going to leave more confused than when you got there. Like, he's going to help you out a little bit to keep you going, but he's not going to overwhelm you with stuff because he knows that's really not helping you.
Yeah, exactly. So, and again, like I said, he's the man. Anybody that's looking to get your shocks done or looking to get new shocks or anything like that, I would definitely go to Micah, and that's who I recommend to everybody.
Yeah, me too.
And as far as like helping people, I mean, he helps so many people.
Yeah.
And it's not like he'll help people even if they're not like a sponsored rider. Like, they go to him for help, and he goes, all right, let me see what I can do for it.
Yeah.
So, I think that's pretty cool. And that's hard to find. So
it is, especially in nowadays where their customer service seems to be like a lost art, or just something that I think a lot of companies now, that, and I'm not saying any companies that we deal with in particular, I pretty much all of the people that we deal with are just awesome with customer service. And that's one of the reasons why I like being with them. But just outside of it and just your everyday life, I think customer service is just one of those things where it's like these companies have got to the point where it's like, okay, well, there's only two cell phone companies out there that are really worth paying money for. So either they're going to get upset with that company and come to us, or they'll get upset and go with them. I mean, they're still, it's all a wash in the end. And, you know, the customer service like really sucks anymore. It's like nobody really cares. And like, that's why I like dealing with the people that we do, like people with Micah and, you know, Liz Harper and like Chris Shoup does our engines. And I can ask Shoup anything, like the dumbest question possible that anybody that even could get in a vehicle and turn the key and understand it, but I'll have a brain fart and ask him. And, you know, he'll answer me pretty much any time that he can. I've asked him questions sometimes at like 7 o'clock in the evening, and he's just so wrapped up like getting stuff done. Like he'll text me at like 2 in the morning. And I'll get up and I'll look and I'll be like, there's a message here from Shoup. And I'm like, what the hell did I even ask him? But he gets back to me. And, but like all of the people that we deal with are like that. And we're very fortunate to have such a good group of, support with, you know, all our products that I can't speak highly enough for them. And I tell everybody that, you know, if they're looking for shocks, and because I'll field the Facebook questions every now and then that they'll say, you know, looking to get shocks, you know, what's out there. And every time I'll make sure to, you know, tag Mike or tag Custom Access. But I think the one thing is like, there's a lot of people out there that want the benefits of it, but maybe they can't afford them, or, you know, they don't want to spend the money on them. But If there was one thing that you absolutely were going to spend money on these bikes, I would say suspension is first and foremost the first place you should go to spend your money.
Oh, for sure. If the bike doesn't handle, it doesn't matter how much motor you have.
Right, right. And it's not even enjoyable riding it because you're just getting beat to death. When I first got my bike, and it had stock suspension on it, it just beat me to death. And then, you know, I'm still waiting to get a set of Custom Access on it. And I don't know that I'll ever be able to justify getting a set on there unless I can get a really good deal or like a used set and then have Micah rework them. But for the amount of riding that I do, it would be more of just a luxury than just a have to have.
You're a casual rider.
Yeah, I mean,
a weekend cruiser, if you will.
I don't think that I can even outride a set of stock shocks. So putting a set of Custom Access on would just be just the ultimate flex, pretty much for me.
Well, I mean, I'm not. I like Access. Don't get me wrong, but my stock shocks work pretty good too.
Yeah.
So I can't complain about those. It just the way Suzuki's are set up, the stock stuff works pretty good. I'm not saying they definitely don't work as good as my Axis stuff, but
it's funny because I'm not funny like in that way, but it's interesting that like a lot of the stuff that Suzuki has, like the LTR geometry, like how many people run that geometry on their Hondas, on their Yamahas? And I mean, Suzuki doesn't even make those bikes anymore. Like they were the first ones to actually come out with the four wheelers. And now it's just like everyone's using their stuff and they're not even making stuff anymore.
I mean, I don't have any problems getting parts.
No. Yeah. But you're,
oh, I'm saying
you're one of the few people that are still running them, though. So you got the lion's share of all the parts.
Well, I like any of my OEM parts that I need, I can get next day aired to me. Just because if there's a Suzuki dealership, Suzuki's supposed to send their stuff next day aired. Right?
Oh, really?
Yeah. So like wiring harnesses, stuff like that, we can get next day to us. So I don't usually have any problems getting like factory parts or anything. I would say the hardest thing to get on my four-wheeler, which isn't even really that hard, just the longest lead time that I would have for something on my four-wheeler, is my A-arms. That's just because they're Walsh. Okay. So
that's the question I was going to ask you. Is it because they were Walsh or just the OEM stuff? But you're saying like aftermarket stuff.
Yeah, I'm saying anything on my four-wheeler, aftermarket, stock, anything like that, I can probably have in a couple of days, anything I need. And then the A-arms take like 6 to 8 weeks to build. So, and I only have the one set, but it would be nice to get another. It would be nice to get another set, but they're like
$1,800
or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, they're probably worth it because they definitely make a world of difference.
I know when you were telling me when we were talking and you were like, man, you told me what happened. You're like, I don't have $1,800 for a set of A-arms. And I'm like, I start looking, I'm like, well, it's not Lone Star. It's not Hauser. I'm like, I know who it is. So I pulled up Walsh and I was like, yep, it's Walsh.
Yeah. On Yamaha, stuff like that. I mean, yeah, you could probably run Hauser. You could probably run Lone Star. Whatever you want. When it comes to Suzuki's, though, if you want your Suzuki to handle, it definitely makes a huge difference when you go to the Walsh front end.
Yeah.
So I ran Hauser, I ran Ars Effects, I ran the stock stuff, I ran all kinds of different stuff on my bikes throughout the years. And when I put the Walsh stuff on, that definitely, I picked up a lot of time by changing the front end over to the Walsh stuff. So where I may have been losing 30 or 40 seconds a lap before, I was making up that time, no problem.
Wow.
And it handles so much better. You can take a turn. I can lay into a turn with that setup as opposed to like some other setups. Way less energy used and be able to just hammer into it. I don't know why specifically, like I've never checked the angles on everything and stuff like that to actually be like, well, this is exactly what he does differently as far as like where the ball joint sits and different stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it definitely makes a huge difference. And then, like I said earlier in the show, there's not as many adjustments. So like, I'm not adjusting my ball joint and heim joints or anything like that. I'm literally the top A arm as the two heim joints that go to the frame, and they have the spacers obviously to fit in the holes, but you adjust those heim joints to get your camber set, and everything else is a set component to the A-arms. So they definitely got to figure it out.
Now, when everyone talks about like their Yamahas have LTR geometry, I have a limited knowledge about that, but what's the difference? What is the benefits of the LTR geometry? Is it just a better turning radius, or is it better? Like, I don't know, because obviously I don't have that. So I don't know really what I'm missing, because like I said, I don't think I'm even fully to the point of, outriding what I have now. But what are the benefits of having the LTR geometry as opposed to, you know, your stock geometry on a Yamaha, say?
I mean, definitely the turning. That's the number one reason people go with Suzuki geometry. The turning is just superior to any other thing that's out there. So if you want to get into a turn and you want to be able to lay into that thing and be able to handle the turn good, then that's going to be the way to go. So as far as like specifics, I mean, the ball joint kind of changes a little bit. The knuckle is a little bit different. So you're moving things around in the front end, and then like your turning radiuses and stuff like that. And I don't know what that exact number would be as far as that would go. Yeah. But that's a general idea, is you can take a turn better with it because you change a little bit of the geometries. What some people don't think about those when you say LTR geometry, okay, well, you're changing the spindle setup. So yeah, it is going to handle a little bit better. You got to turn a little bit better. But they don't ever talk about the difference in geometry of how the shock lays on the four-wheeler either. So, like, put Suzuki spindles on a Honda, and guess what? It may turn a little bit better, but it still ain't going to turn like a Suzuki because the shock doesn't sit the same way.
Right.
You ever look at a Honda? Yeah. If you ever look at a Honda, the shock is more like straight up and down, right? It's not exactly straight up and down, but like it's closer into the bike, correct? Suzuki, the shock lays out further. So, yes, people are switching to LTR geometry spindles and stuff, and it does help. But at the end of the day, like, if the shock and everything is not in the same line, it's not exactly the same. Like, the flags don't sit perfectly in the same place. The shock's not perfectly on the same angle. Right. So, to say that you switch it over to some of these things, and I know when you switch to LTR geometry, like Pierce Performance has a flag that you can change and stuff like that, but it's still not exact to what LTR would be. So you can get close, but you're never going to be able to match it.
It'd be kind of like putting a slip on exhaust on. Like, yes, you're doing something, but you're not doing exactly everything that you need to do in order to do that. Like, it like be putting a, like you put a lift kit on a truck, you know, you could either just turn the torsion bars up and then get a front end alignment, but you're still, everything isn't working the way that it should be. Like, you're putting more stress on other areas, and to do it the right way, you have to remount things. You have to make sure that everything works in accordance and you're not fighting something when something's doing something else, I guess would be the best way to put it.
Exactly. So like it, mostly just talking for like the people that are listening to this after, right? Yeah. When they come back and listen to this, I didn't want them to be like, oh yeah, LTR geometry is like going to fix all my problems. It's like, no, it's a solution to fix some of your problem, not the whole thing. So even if you put LTR geometry on your Yamaha, it's still not going to be exactly an LTR.
Right.
There's a lot more components to it than just, yeah, let me switch the front end over and now it's going to be exactly like an LTR. You have to break it down a lot further to be able to see exactly why the bike does what it does. I mean, the frames are built completely different. So like even to say, even if you put the shock on the same pitch, right? Like, there's other components there. The frame could flex a little bit differently than what a Yamaha does or a Honda does or something like that. So there's a lot more into it. But obviously the goal is, okay, I want my bike to handle better. Well, it's going to help you. It's just, if you've rode a Suzuki and you jump on a Yamaha, don't expect it to be exactly the same. So that's my main thing to make sure everybody is on the same page there. So
you can get, get close is what you're saying. You can get fairly close, but it's not going to be the same thing.
Yep. Never going to be exactly the same. So, people give me a hard time too about riding Suzuki's for so long and you need to ride Yamahas and stuff like that. And I'm like, wow, I went to a Yamaha last year and that didn't go well. So guess what? I finished the season on and I was on the podium most of the time I was on that. So,
I think it's, I mean, in a perfect world, we'd have a bunch of different machines to choose from. And I mean, we still do, but we would have newer models, you know, updated models with stuff like that in a perfect world. But like right now we have what we have. So you're kind of stuck with that. But I kind of like look back when I was pretty much Colton's age, and I was playing baseball. Baseball.
It's either baseball or fishing.
Baseball. This is the first time I've ever brought baseball up on this podcast.
Oh.
It's usually fishing.
It's most of the time fishing.
Yeah, well, that's like your go-to thing. Like, I got to say something.
I think somebody might have drank a bottle of Haterade before he came on the show.
Yeah, tell me about it.
No, it was water.
But, everyone was using these. Easton came out with like this gold bat that was supposed to be like the best bat out there. And we had got one, and I was a pretty good hitter. And there was this old, like just regular Easton bat that like every time I picked it up, just you ever get a hold of something, whether it's racing or whatever it is, like it may not be like what they tote is like their top of the line, best thing they ever had, but you just pick it up and it just, everything about it just feels just perfect. Like you can't do anything wrong with it. And like, that's the way that bat was with me. Like I'd pick it up and I'd be like, man, just, it feels just perfect. Like it was custom made for me, but.
And you still miss.
No. I had to use the gold bat because I had it in my head that it was like, this is the best thing ever. I'll be able to hit the ball, you know, 100 feet farther with this gold bat. And the actual reality of it was like, that wasn't the case because it just didn't fit me well. And I think that's kind of getting back to this point is just because there may be the best bike in the world out there. If you don't feel comfortable with it, like that's not the best bike for you. Like the best bike for you is whatever you feel comfortable on. So like if you feel comfortable on a 300 EX and you can do things with it because you feel more comfortable, then you're better off riding a 300 EX than say a 450R or a, any 450. It just goes back to, you know, what you feel comfortable with. And I think that's the biggest thing. And like, you know, getting back with shocks and stuff like that. If you can make it so you're comfortable, being comfortable solves a lot of problems that you really don't need to get into, so to speak, I guess. Because if you're comfortable with it, you can make that machine do things that you can't make another machine do, even though you might have the power to do it. And I think that's one thing that's really overlooked.
Yeah. Being comfortable with something is definitely the number one priority.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's the top of the line or whatever it is. As long as you're comfortable with it, you can make it do whatever you need it to do. So
yeah,
it's like, it doesn't matter if you have a lot of people run steering stabilizers, right? I don't run one. Well, when I put a steering stabilizer on, I feel that it stiffens up the steering too much and I don't like it.
Uh-huh.
I like being able to feel the feedback in the handlebars. So when I'm hitting stuff, I like being able to feel that because I know what to do for it. Whereas with steering stabilizer, even on the lowest setting, I feel like it's too stiff. So I shouldn't say too stiff, but like I don't get as much of that as I like.
Yeah.
Because it takes some of it away, which is the point of a steering stabilizer. But I'm more comfortable running without it. So I just don't run because of whatever reason in my head, it seems like it works better when I don't run.
Yeah. I went and bought one. I mean, I bought a used one and had it redone and everything just because I thought, well, hell, everyone's running steering stabilizer. Like I need to get this because, you know, that's just the way it is. And I think part of my reasoning behind getting one was not necessarily to, quote unquote, make me faster. I was trying to get it just to kind of take some of the beating off me, but I don't know that I really even notice a difference on it. Like maybe it's not set up right. And that could 100% be the reason that I don't feel any different, but like, I don't know that putting the steering stabilizer on there really even made a difference for me, to be honest.
Well, Barry Hawk always says the best steering stabilizer you have on your body, right?
Yeah.
Your arms.
Yeah.
So he's always said that. So that's just kind of my thing that I've went with. But I know a lot of people will be like, A lot of people told me they can't ride without them.
Really?
So, yeah.
And I think it's a lot of things too. Like the more you put on a bike, the more you're opening yourself up to a potential problem. Like if your steering stabilizer messes up, well, now you're kind of screwed. But if you didn't have it, well, then it's not going to mess up. That's one less thing. It's like the keep it simple, stupid method. The less stuff to go wrong, the better off you are. Now, some things are unavoidable, but you know, I try to keep it as simple as possible, but that's not always the case.
Use the KISS method, right?
Yeah, the KISS method.
Yeah. So like Bryson Neal, after Wild Boar, he came in and was talking about his steering stabilizer messing up. Hunter Hart, we still don't know what the problem was with him at Camp Coder, but he said he couldn't steer left or right.
Yeah.
So,
or straight. He said he couldn't pretty much do anything.
Yeah. So what's the only thing that you can put on the front of your bike that's going to keep you from being able to do anything like that?
Yeah. A steering stabilizer.
Typically. Again, yeah. I don't know 100% what that is that caused this problem, but one would assume that the only thing on the front of his four-wheeler that would keep him from being able to do any of those three things would be a steering stabilizer, because if it would stiffen up or not work correctly, well, what's it going to do? It's not going to let it steer. So it is just, it's another thing that you add in there, like you said, that can go wrong. So building big motors, more horsepower, more problems.
Yep.
So thinking about stuff like that, like I try to do the same thing. Keep it as simple as possible. I run stock motors. There's less maintenance on them. They are more dependable. Again, I'm not saying that they can't break, but more dependable typically. I don't run steering stabilizers, so a steering stabilizer can't mess up on me. So I have like the bare minimum stuff to be able to make it do what I want it to do. So that's what I try to focus on, and things that I try to do. But
now, kind of taking a detour here from the technical side of the podcast, and I'm only saying it because you brought it up. Is there anybody? Well, I know there is somebody, but who do you think is going to be the one to step up and start putting the heat on Bryson from here on out? Because so far, like, no one's really had a— we've had brief flashes. We had, you know, Walker got real close to him in Georgia. And then South Carolina, you know, Walker said he was just having some issues and stuff like that. And, you know, now you got Josh Merritt, who is just— I don't know what kind of deal he made with the devil over the winter, but he's just came out as like this possessed rider. And you know, he was been talking about, like, you know, I don't know how much I'm going to do this. And I texted him, I said, dude, if you've done anything this year, you've just made it even harder for yourself in the off season if you were thinking about stepping away. But who, in your opinion, like, who's going to be the guy that is going to put the heat on Bryson? Because right now it's— I mean, I like all these guys. I'm good. I'm not friends with them all, but you know, I'm amicable and I like them all. I'd like to see all of them win. But who's going to be that guy that is going to be the one that says, I've had enough and I'm coming?
Well, I was kind of hoping I opened this question up so that we could talk about this. A couple things here. Bryson is somebody that at this point in his career knows how to manage a race, right?
Yeah.
He's lost enough races in his career to Fowler from not managing races. Wins the championship. He figures out, okay, I can do this. Well, what's the next thing that he can improve on? Learning how to manage the race better so that way it goes in his favor more.
Right.
Well, each year he continues to get better at that. Camp Coker, I think what we saw was somebody that came out to prove a point, right? He's been managing the first few rounds. Georgia was a mud fest. So all you had to do was just enough there. He knew that there was only a few places on the track that somebody could pass him. The one place that he probably thought Walker would go for it, Walker went for it, right? So at that point, all he had to do was go just fast enough to block him. If he did that, he could pretty much hold him off anywhere else on the track because there wasn't very many lines that you could jump out of the ruts on. So he knows these things in the back of his head really well. Florida, Walker again was the guy that held him at bay until the end of the race. So you start looking at the results, you start looking at lap times and stuff like that. At this point in time, the only person on that front row that even has a chance of beating Bryson is Walker. So back to the Camp Coker, because I was talking about his different riding styles at each round, right? We talk about Camp Coker. Walker had a bad start. Yeah. So don't get me wrong. Walker definitely had a bad start. That did not help him or do him any favors, right?
That did not help his cause, considering that's one of his strong points, regardless of how his race goes. He's always been known as the whole shot guy, the starter guy.
Yeah, he's the guy that gets out front early and sprints away.
Right.
That was his thing. Bill Bounce, Chris Borch, where the last turn passes, I'm going to beat you right at the finish, guys. Walker came through, and when he was winning his championships, he set the tone for the new style. Okay, well, I'm going to get out front, I'm going to sprint as hard as I can and pull as much gap as possible, and then I manage the race from there. Well, Walker's not been in that position where he can really do that other than Florida. So Florida, he gets out with Bryson, he follows Bryson, he stays with him for a while, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a lot easier to know what that pace is if you can see.
Right.
So back to Camp Coker then. Walker has a bad start, but Walker still got to the front relatively
quickly.
Quick, right? It's not like he was stuck there forever. He got to the front relatively quick. And I get along with Walker. I have no issues with Walker. But Bryson was riding like a guy that wanted to prove a point that he can completely destroy anybody he's racing against. So you don't win a race by almost 5 minutes just because you managed the race. I'm going to go out here because I'm in the front early and I'm going to push as hard as I can. And I'm going to prove a point of who the baddest man on the line is right now. So he was not far away from being able to be close to the record for biggest win at a GNCC and did it with nobody else having issues.
Yeah.
So that tells me that we're going to be hard pressed to find somebody that can do that. But again, I think if anybody does it, it's got to be Walker because he's the only guy that's even kept him at bay. Josh Merritt did a good job at the first round, keeping him pretty close, right?
Yep.
But go back and look at the footage from Camp Coker. Bryson started pulling that gap pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I love what Josh has been doing. I'm super stoked to see him on the podiums and stuff like that. But you could definitely tell the mentality change at Camp Coker as opposed to some of these other races that we had ran earlier. And go back and watch the drone footage and stuff and watch what happens when Bryson gets in the lead and Josh is trying to keep up, right? So, again, nothing against Josh. It's just an opinion, right? It's just right. An opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nothing bad against them. It's nothing saying that they aren't riding well. It's just you ask me who can beat Bryson, I don't think anybody can.
Well, and that's one of those things, too. It's just because somebody is at the level they're at that doesn't knock down anybody else's level. It's just Bryson is it's like one of those generational things that you see that just out of nowhere, and it just mystifies everybody. It's like, how does somebody do what they do? And I mean, that's what I look at. It's like, how does he do it? Like, what is it that makes him be able to do that? Is it just that he's that strong on the bike and is able to manhandle it and basically make that bike do what he wants it to do, whether the bike wants it to do it or not? Is it something that everybody has? Is it something that only he has? I mean, I'm fairly new in like looking at all this stuff. So like some of the stuff I don't know, and it's just like, what is it? What changed in Bryson 2 years ago that turned him into this unstoppable animal that he is right now? Because let's face it, like, he is like, if you were crossing sports here, he was like, right now you take Michael Jordan and LeBron James and you put them together, and that's Bryson Neal. Like, it's just one of those things right now. And I don't know how you get to that point.
So I don't know what changed for him. I don't know what made him go to the level he's at right now, right? Because there was a point in time that if you would have asked somebody if Bryson was ever going to be the champion, they probably would have said no.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't somebody that came up through. He was and he wasn't. He was somebody that came up through and everybody knew he was going to be in the front and he was probably going to win races. But he wasn't somebody that they were picking to be a multi-time champion, right?
Yeah.
And at some point, probably 4 years ago, is when he started really, really changing his speed and the way he was riding and stuff like that. So when he started riding on the Magna One stuff, I think that became a big turning point in his program. I think having freedom to do a lot of things with the bike and stuff like that definitely helps. I think that made a huge difference. So having the parts available to do stuff, being able to make those free decisions on what you want to do with every part that you could possibly get your hand on, that makes a huge difference.
Oh, absolutely.
So I don't know what truly flipped the switch, but I know probably about 4 years ago is when he started being like, oh man, this guy is coming. And he is pissed at the world. And exactly how he rides the floor too. As calm tempered and walking around with a smile and stuff like that all the time as he is off the bike, when he rides the four-wheeler, he just rides that thing like he wants to kill it. That's the only way you can describe it. He just rides it like he wants to kill it. So I don't know what it was that truly flipped the switch, but I know I could see it coming in the past 4 years, and he is just on a whole nother level. And how somebody else gets there, I don't know what that looks like, because yeah, it's just, we haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I mean, Walker was a 7-time champion and Walker had a lot of speed, but I don't know that it was the same. Right. So,
well, no one's ever the same, like, because you go from champion to champion to champion, and each one of them, when you take the similarities away, there's big differences in how they were able to become that next champion. And like you said, like Borch and Balance, like they were just lurkers. They would let you get out there. They'd make you feel good about yourself. And then in the last lap, they were just like, okay, I've had enough of this. We're going to make the pass. And then, like you said, Walker took that one step further and said, okay, well, we're not going to do it on the last lap. We're going to do it from turn one and we're just going to check out. And then now you have Bryson that's kind of doing the same thing. I mean, it's not as easy for me to make the differences between Walker and Bryson than it is for me to say Walker and Chris or Walker and Bill. Like, to me right now, and maybe it's not because, maybe it's because I don't know as much about the styles and everything, it's like, and not saying this in a bad way, but it's almost like Bryson is Walker 2.0. And that's not taking anything away from what Bryson is doing, because Bryson is, he's his own man. He's doing his own thing. But it's like those two styles really aren't that much different as, say, Walker and Bryson and Chris and Bill Balance. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. So I think one thing you're leading to there is with Balance and Borch, they battled for I mean, Bounce won 9 championships and Bortz was there for all of them, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah, he was there for all of them. Sorry, I had to think back and make sure I was correct on that. So Bortz was the young kid coming in. Bortz had way more raw speed, but he would take himself out.
Yeah.
He was not the guy that thought about stuff. And he was the guy that would win a bunch of races, but never win the championship because he would wreck and break his collarbone on the pavement at Wisp, right? Like, who does that?
Yeah.
Who comes into the pavement section, flips your bike, and breaks your collarbone on the pavement?
Yeah.
Like, got an opportunity to win a championship, and you're going to do something stupid. So at that point in his career, he was doing all kinds of stupid stuff. But what happened was Bounce would always do that last lap catch and pass Bortz type deal, right? He was the guy that was always there. Bortz would be settled in. Oh, I got this one. Here comes Bounce. And he scrub turns him or something and passes him right at the finish. Well, what's that do? That ingrains in Bortz's head and says, all right, you know what? I'm going to do the same exact thing. So Bounce is gone. Who's the next guy that's logical to step up?
Yeah.
Chris Bortz. Well, Bounce has been doing this to him for years. So what's his next logical step? Okay, well, I'm just going to sit back here and relax. And then when we get to a certain point on the last lap, I'm going to decide where I want to pass. Sometimes that's the last turn. Sometimes that's a few miles before the last turn, right? Mm-hmm. But he was a lurker. He just sat there and waited. They were either going to make a mistake or he had somewhere in his head that he knew he was going to make a pass. Then you get to Fowler. And Fowler from Bounce. Okay? Bounce is like his coach, telling him what to do. But Fowler is also a new generation of rider that was a huge, I shouldn't say huge, but way bigger age gap from Bortz to Fowler on riding styles as opposed to like Bounce to Bortz.
Mm-hmm.
Comes in with a whole riding style, but he also has a 9-time champion in his corner, Tony, to do stuff. Well, Fowler's got extreme sprint speed. So what's the logical thing to do if your biggest strength is sprint speed? I'm going to try to get out front. I'm going to try to pull as big of a gap as possible. So you have a 9-time champion going, hey, you're really fast at the beginning of a race. I think you should use that to your advantage. Well, now the riding style is going to change because before it was, okay, let's get out of here. We're going to settle in. People are going to ride together. This is how the race is going to go. To, okay, now Fowler's in the mix. He pulls the whole shot. He's going to ride 100% right from the get-go. So there is no settle in and figure out what you're going to do later. It's, oh, crap. We are going to go wide open now. So then you got Bryson that comes in, and he's kind of in the same position as what Bortz was with Bounce, right?
Yeah.
Bryson's coming in. Well, Fowler's got the sprint speed, so what's Bryson have to do? He has to build up that sprint speed, because if he doesn't and Walker gets out too far in the beginning of a race, it's over. So then he's got to go back to the drawing board and work on that. So I think you become a product of trying to think the best way to word that. You become a product of your circumstance, right?
Right.
So the circumstance was Fowler's a sprinter. Bryson has to learn how to be a sprinter. For Bortz, it was Bounce is a guy that will pass you in the last turn. So I'm going to be a guy that will pass you in the last turn. So you become a product of your circumstance, and the circumstance just happened to be different for the two. That's the biggest thing that I see is you kind of learn from what you're beat by. So,
and speaking on what you said too, is like before, even though Bryson had that speed, you never knew if it was going to be the part where he would just break the bike in half or something would happen. Well, like now you said, he's learning to manage the races, and he's learning that. And I say learning, saying like I'm like this much smarter, but this is just being an outside observer on it at seeing what we're talking about. And it's almost like he's looking at like wherein before he would just hammer all the way through it. Like now he's looking at it and saying, well, I don't have to hammer here because I can hammer 90 other percent of the places as opposed to hammering 100% through it. And now I'm not putting that in the mix where I might break the bike in half. Cause I think you even told me once, it's like when Bryson gets done with a race, like that bike is pretty much unrideable, until it gets rebuilt. And, you know, I think that's really where he becomes really dangerous now, is you add all the sprint speed and you're managing the races. That becomes really hard to figure out, because what's the next step? That's what somebody's got to figure out, is what is that next step that you got to add to whatever Bryson's doing to beat Bryson. And that's what's going to be hard to figure out, because nobody knows what it is now. Like, I mean, maybe somebody does, and you know, it's just hard to, it's harder to put into actions than it is into theory. But there's got to be something else. And when it is, then we'll all be talking about that. And it's going to be like, well, yeah, it's so obvious now. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see when somebody comes up and starts knocking on Bryson's door, what they're doing to do that.
I definitely think, logically speaking, it's going to be Fowler. Fowler will definitely be the first guy to figure it out, because he's a 7-time champion and he's smart enough to go back and look at the races, and he's smart enough to look at the lap times and say, okay, I see where he's beating me. They get enough video footage around the track too, where he can try to break it down into intervals and say, okay, well, he's faster than me here, but I might be faster than him in this other place. The other thing is Walker has way more experience carrying the number one plate, right? So there's no amount of pressure that you put on Walker that is going to break him at this point. The only pressure he probably ever experienced as champion was the big thing for him. He won the first championship. He said, I don't want to be the first guy not to back it up, right? Because traditionally before that, everybody backed it up. So Walker has zero pressure on him at this point. He has all the experience in the world, and he doesn't necessarily have to have the sprint speed that Bryson has if he can have more racecraft than Bryson has. So it may be the difference in Bryson just kind of manhandles his bike through a line, and Walker has a different line that he can kind of finesse his bike through, right? So it's not beating the crap out of him. He's not muscling the bike through. He's not wasting any energy that he doesn't have to waste. Anything like that. I think that's probably the logical way to beat him. Again, this is us looking from the outside in.
Yeah, it's Ben.
I'm not running those speeds. Yeah. I'm not running those speeds myself. But if that's literally all you do is race, then it's a lot easier to figure out what you need to fix and how to fix it to be able to beat somebody. So I think if anybody does it, it's definitely going to be Walker, and he's going to use his experience to beat him, not necessarily his speed.
And talking on that point, I think the next step that somebody is going to put together, and you kind of mentioned it, is with as much coverage as we have now and video that we have now, I think the next step is going to be more just breaking down the races to a micro level instead of looking at it as a macro level, and being able to look at it and say, okay, well, physically we're kind of tapped out where we are right now, with whether it be the bikes or conditioning or whatever it is. Like, we're going as fast as we can, you know, each person individually. The next step is going to be kind of like fine tuning it, looking at the footage and saying, okay, well, I noticed on this particular setup, and it may come down to that, like, it's on this particular setup in this kind of turn in these conditions on this part of the track, I'm faster than him. So how do I replicate that to a degree to make it more beneficial around the track? And you notice that more and more nowadays with just the advent and the introduction to more coverage and more footage, that, you know, people are looking at the footage now and being able to dissect a race way better than they were in the past. Cause in the past you could dissect it basically by what you've seen as you were racing. Well, now you can dissect a lot more stuff because now somebody else has footage of it from a different angle and you're completely removed from it. So now you can see it from a different angle in a different perspective and be able to just break it down from there. I think if you held a gun to my head, I think that might be the next logical step that would bring somebody to that next level. I mean, maybe it's something else, but I mean, just looking at it, like, and looking at other avenues of how footage and just looking at stuff from that point has improved other athletes, I think that might be one of the things that takes somebody to the next level.
Yeah, for sure. Drones is number one thing to use if you're in the XC1 Plus.
Yeah.
So if you're chasing Bryson, the drone's to your advantage. The drone follows him all the way around the track.
Yeah.
You can put that down into whatever rules you want. So you want to measure a mile, how long it takes you to make that mile, right? And then you want to see how long it takes you to make that mile. Well, if you're in the XC1 class and you're close to the front, you're going to be on the camera at some point to where you can figure out what that interval was for you. So South Carolina, for instance, they had the pro hill climb, right? And then I think it was the FMF power or monster mile maybe later where it popped up and it was like a couple miles after the hill climb, right?
Yeah.
Those guys are on the camera enough to be able to say, okay, it was this time when I hit this spot. It was this time when I hit this spot. Break that down into an interval and see if they're faster in between those two sections, how much time they lost in between that. But the drone footage is nice too, especially when you start hitting fields and stuff, because then you can see how much faster somebody is in the turns and how much faster somebody is getting out of them and across the straight stretch. So the drones follow them everywhere. Well, use that. There's literally a clock, the Racer TV thing, along with drone footage that'll tell you exactly what you're trying to accomplish. So it's not even like you have to pull out a separate timer and be able to like really focus on what you're doing. It's okay, here's how fast he hit it. And then if you're in that same camera shot or something like that, rewind it and see how fast you hit it. It's not rocket science, right?
Yeah.
So even if you're the same camera shot and he has a gap on you, like you can still interval yourself out because you may close in that gap in that timeline and see how much different it was. So different ways to do it. Definitely things that we can use to our advantage. I use the Racer TV footage a lot, trying to work on what I need to work on even. And it makes a huge difference. Or I'll use like GoPro footage from other people and just look at the tracks and how the track breaks down and figuring that stuff out too. So that way when it's beating the crap out of me in the middle of a race, the last thing I'm thinking about is what the track truly looks like. Right.
Right.
But if I go back and watch somebody's GoPro footage, the track broke down in a certain way, they, you know, adjust my body to make it work better in those conditions. So I try to really break stuff down or like go back and look at your lap times. Think about what happened on each lap. So an example that I can bring up and we can talk to Colton about is look at your lap times from New East Coast, right? Mm-hmm. First lap, not bad. Second lap, not bad. What was the third lap? You know what it was?
What was it?
Oh.
He doesn't know. I just go out there. I ride the bike,
and I make sure that I go fast. I don't look at all that.
Well, you should start looking at that because that's a lot of good information that is out there at your disposal. And I'm going to pull it up right now. You probably already have it up, Devin, because you're asking the question.
Well, I mean, I look at this stuff all the time anyways, but I did pull it back up. So your first lap, you're in a 14:09. Second lap, you're in a 15:19. Then you went to a 16:12. And then you ran a 16:13, right?
Yeah.
So your last few laps were pretty much identical. Your second lap was roughly a minute faster. And then your first lap was obviously faster because the track was a little bit shorter, right?
Right. So you can usually throw out that first lap as far as comparing them to the other ones. I always look at like from lap two on because those are identical track at that point.
Yeah, so the example I was going to use, though, with the particular track we're talking about, the start was almost at the finish, correct? So the amount of track that you're not really riding on that first lap was
negligible.
It was like 50 yards, right? So roughly, until you got to probably your third lap, there probably wasn't a ton of lappers to go through. So on a track like CJ, lap times are going to be relatively close. So whatever your first lap is, means that you should be able to run fairly close. You're not going to be exact, but like you're going to be relatively close to that lap. But if you think back to your race, and this is what I was leading him to and something that he can talk about because he's personally out there, and that's why I used him as an example, right? Because he's somebody on the show that can personally talk about what was going on. And then it shows how you can use lap time to dissect what you could have done differently or things that you can think about when you go back and look at stuff like this. So when you start talking about Bryson or Walker and those guys, they can do the same exact thing.
Right. I mean,
it doesn't matter what level you're at. But on the 14:09, you were in fourth, and then you dropped back to fifth for the rest of the race. So I don't know what happened in between checkpoints. You could have made some passes and stuff like that. But the point I'm getting at is your first lap was 14:09. It's basically the same length track. And by the end of the race, you were 2 minutes slower. Right. By the third lap, you're 2 minutes slower. Fourth lap, almost identical to your third lap. When you think back to the race, was there anything that you could think of during that race that you would be like, you know what, if I would have done that a little bit differently, I probably could have been closer to that lap time that I was shooting for. And just kind of like give us a little bit of feedback on how that race went for you and things that went on. So that way it's just kind of an example just so people get an understanding of what we truly mean. Right.
Yeah. So I did hit a tree, which you probably know that by now.
And what lap, what lap was that?
Three.
Okay. So
I think
that kind of throws that out of the equation because your third lap and fourth lap are the same pretty much. And you didn't hit a tree on lap four. So that means you take away the tree on lap three. And if you were stuck for what you said, almost a minute,
maybe, yeah.
Now you're closer to the lap two time. So something happened on lap four that, and that's what we're trying to take us through it.
Yeah.
Like
nothing really happened on lap four. I just think I got tired because I hadn't, you know, raced in since whatever that was
last year.
Yeah.
Yep.
Was there any points where, like, in any sections that you felt you didn't hit it as fast?
Or, yeah, there's turns that I could have hit harder, sections that I could have went faster through.
And that's what we're trying to like drag out of you right now. So
there you go.
I mean, no, I was in no way, I'm in no way calling you out on anything, right?
Oh, I am.
I was using that.
Yeah,
as
I know you are.
Well, I'm using that as an example of that's how you can use lap times to your advantage. So like on lap three, you hit a tree, right? Well, that makes sense because now your lap time slowed down. And then on lap four, I don't know if anything happened to the bike or not, or if you just got tired because you were trying to get unstuck off of the tree or something like that, right?
Yeah, and my arm hurt a little bit.
Yeah, which, I mean, typically you hit a tree, something's going to hurt, right? So the point I was getting at is you go back and look at your lap times and you in no way rode bad because you still had a good result. And the main thing I'm looking at getting at here is the kid that beat you in your class ran an 18:09 on the last lap, right? So if you wouldn't have hit the tree on the third lap and you would have had a clean fourth lap, now guess what happens? You just beat that kid.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he had you by 51 seconds on the second lap.
Yep. That's basically
for fourth place, right?
That's the tree incident right there.
So all I'm getting at is you can use the lap times to think back to what happened on those laps, and then you can use that to your advantage to say, okay, well, at the end of the race, I was only, 5 seconds, right?
Yeah,
you were five seconds off of
fourth.
Off the guy in fourth.
Yeah.
Okay. Third place ran in 18:42 on his last lap. So you were 5 seconds off of fourth, and fourth was 51 seconds off of that guy. So minus the tree out, you cut a minute off there. You're already in front of the fourth place guy if you didn't hit the tree. And then the fact that that dude ran in 18:42 and you ran a 16:13, well, now you're positive minutes on that guy. So, again, it was in no way to call you out and say, hey, your lap times look on par. It was, hey, what happened on this lap that was different than this lap caused that to happen? And then if you were to think back to that, okay, what do I need to do to fix that to keep it from happening next time? And then saying, okay, well, if that doesn't happen next time, I'm on the podium, right? So it's just it was an example to use because you're on the show with us to talk about it, and something that we could be able to use to our advantage because you're physically on the track, and now we know, okay, well, you hit a tree, your arm hurt, and you probably were a little bit tired from trying to get your foot off the tree. So there are all things to expect. It was an example of how you can use that to your advantage and think back to things that you can fix. Well, same thing happens when you're in the front and you're running with XC1. Walker Fowler goes back and says, oh man, Bryson Neal was 30 seconds faster on me in that lap. Well, what's Walker going to do? He's going to think back to every turn that he hit on the track, every bump that he hit on the track, every set of trees that he took, every line he picked. He's going to think of all of these things that happened, and he's going to figure out where he can pick up that 30 seconds at. So that's the main thing to go off of. And then you use the drones even when you're those guys, and then you can break it down. They can break it down even further than what we can just by looking at laptops. But, you know, go back and watch GoPro footage.
I really wish they would kind of allow the GoPro footage back. And I know they haven't outlawed, they haven't did away with the GoPros. They just did away with you being able to wear them on your helmet. But I mean, let's be honest, when you wore them on your helmet, there was a lot more people that had the footage out there because it was a better shot. You were able to clear it a lot easier. It was an easy place to clear it as opposed to putting it on the handlebars where, you know, the shot just isn't as clear. You kind of forget about it because it's out of sight, out of mind. And I really like when we were allowed to wear them on our helmets, there was a lot more footage out there, and it was a lot easier to be able to watch that race. Cause we just talked about it the other day about going back to the GoPro for like the new East Coast. You know, I could look at it and look at his lap times and be like, man, that wasn't bad. And then watch the GoPro footage and be like, wow, man, like there is, even though it's not a bad lap, you can look at it and say, there is so much time that you could make up. And I mean, that's me being somebody that's on the outside looking in. And then, you know, when you're actually riding it, it's easier said than done to be able to do some of that stuff. But yeah, just being able to look at the footage and the lap times, it's so much easier to be able to dissect a race and say, okay, well, if I just did this thing, because I noticed myself braking earlier in the corners and not really attacking the corners. If I can just get better at attacking these corners, I can easily shave not just seconds, but possibly minutes off a lap time. And like, that's huge. And for somebody that's in like Colton's position or, you know, not XC1, like there's so much that you have that you can improve on that it's a lot easier to be able to find that stuff as opposed to being an XC1, like you said, like if Walker's looking for 10 seconds or Josh or any of them, they're looking for 10 seconds. That 10 seconds could be, hey, I was 6 inches off hitting this rut. And, or I guess what I'm trying to say is it's so much harder to find the time when you're at that level than it is to find the time when you're in the youth class. And if you get used to looking for it in the youth class, it's going to be easier for you to find it when it's not as prevalent to find when you're riding faster laps.
Yeah, exactly. The faster you get, you're not looking for minutes anymore.
No.
Looking for 2/10 of a second sometimes. If you say 2/10 of a second in a section,
yeah,
you're talking about making up major ground at that point, right? Because yeah, you're racing so close together. Whereas at like where I race or for Colton coming through and just upping his game all the way until he gets to where he wants to be, right? We're looking at trying to shoot a minute a lot. If we can do that, we're doing good. Which at a local race, you're probably not necessarily looking at that much. But like on a national level, typically there's a little more time that you can gain than what there is at a local. But, you know, there's times that I could shave a minute a lap off, mm-hmm, and that would be plenty for what I need.
Yeah,
it just...
I look at my.
You have to dissect it. You have to think about it. So,
I look at my races when I wear a GoPro, and it is just an encyclopedia of opportunities that I can see. But you're exactly right. The higher you go, and just look at like Supercross. Like if you told somebody that they could shave 30 seconds off a lap, that's unheard of, because you're looking at lap times that are separated by at times hundredths of a second. Like it you're running the same lap times minus hundredths of a second, maybe 2 seconds at the most. Not albeit it's a shorter track, so you can extrapolate that. But it just speaks to the point that I'm making, that the higher you get and the better the competition is, the opportunities are a lot harder to find when you're trying to dissect that race. And if you get in the habit of looking at it now, then it'll be easier for you to dissect it later on, I guess.
Yeah. And I don't just dissect my stuff. Like I literally look at everybody's stuff. So I get in trouble sometimes because I spend way too much time doing this, but like I'll look at pro class, A class, E class, youth, minis, all kinds of different stuff. Like I'll look at lap times for everybody. Right. And then like, I even have some people that come to me for training and stuff like that. And I'll look at their lap times for that. And, you know, to try to find ways that I can help kind of dissect their racing also. So that way it gives me somewhere to help them. And we're always running drills and different stuff like that too. So like we'll set up cone drills and different sections like that. But like I'll dissect the lap times. So that way I can say, okay, let's break this down into mileage, right? So you were 30 seconds faster. The track is, if you're on the minis, you're looking at like 1.5 miles to 2 miles, right? Most of the time.
Yeah.
So you're 30 seconds slower on a lap. If it's a 2 mile track, you're 15 seconds a mile slower. Well, that's a pretty decent gap in a mile. Whereas we get to the adults and you're 30 seconds slower than somebody. Well, the track is now 7 to 8 miles long, sometimes longer, but average local track, we'll say it's 7 to 8 miles. And you're 30 seconds slower and you break that down. Well, that's only 5 seconds a mile I didn't do the actual math off the top of my head right there, but
that's all right.
The point is it's a smaller margin, right? Yeah. So if you got 30 seconds and it's an 8 mile track, you're looking at a little under 4 seconds a mile. So that's not bad.
No, no. And I think the biggest thing is too, and I look at it at this way, because like, I'm very guilty of it. Cause I'll look at it and I'll say, you know, after I talk to Colton, and he'll say, well, this happened and that happened. And I look at it as an aggregate and I'm like, oh, okay. Well, if you'd have not done that and you'd have did this, then you would have been in this place. But you're not taking into account like what happened to the guy in third place, that he ran a 1338 and then ran an 1842. Like, so you can't look at it and be like, okay, if I do all this, then this is where I have to be. You have to look at it in the way that I'm going to look at this and I'm going to improve my race. And then whatever happens, happens, because you can't control what happens to other people. Like, you know, you might do the best you can, and then all of a sudden this guy that runs 5 minutes slower on the last lap, well, he didn't have that breakdown, or he didn't get caught up in a bottleneck. And now you're like, oh man, I did everything right and I still didn't get it. But you know, you just got to look at it as, you know, I'm going to do this to ride the best race that I can, and where the chips fall, that's where they fall. But I'm going to do everything that I can to ride the best race that I can. And I think that's how you have to attack that.
Yeah. And consistency is key too.
Right.
So like, the more consistent you can be, the better your race is going to go. So like, you have lap times pulled up, right?
Yeah.
So Wyatt Dolan, sixth place. His last lap was 29:32.
Yep.
Right. I think there was a bottleneck or something that happened on the last lap that people got stuck in.
Yeah.
On the third lap, when Colton hit the tree, he came in 1 second behind Colton.
Yep.
But he was only able to do that because his lap times were consistent the first two laps.
Yeah.
Right?
15, so 15, like, 15.
Yeah, they pulled a gap on him because they were a little bit faster, but he still had it close enough that when that mistake happened, he was able to close in and take advantage of that. Right. So even though he ran a 29:32, which I do believe there was a bottleneck and some of those guys got stuck, but like, that just goes to show you consistency works too. So if a mistake does happen, or in the case of Colton, he hit the tree and he was not too far off of the guy that finished third, right? Mm-hmm. So if he doesn't, mm-hmm. if Colton doesn't make his mistake of hitting the tree, that other guy made his mistake on the last lap and Colton beats him for a podium. Yeah. So
it's consistency.
That's why, yeah, that's why I say it's important to look at that, because, okay, even though you might not be extremely ecstatic with where, like, I've looked at my results before in lap times and been like, you know, my lap times kind of suck, right? Whether it be from a problem or whether I was just not riding great that day, or whatever the circumstance was, I can still go back and say, okay, well, my lap times were fairly consistent and I beat the guy because I was consistent, because he had a really fast lap here, but he also had a really slow lap here because of some stupid mistake that he made, a wreck, got stuck, whatever it is, doesn't matter, because at the end of the race, when I crossed the finish line, I was in front of him, right? So you don't have to be necessarily the fastest guy on the track. You just have to be able to put yourself in the correct position at all times. So,
But
not to wear you out on that subject.
I think we had a lot of good stuff on this podcast. I mean, we're closing in on 2 hours right now. I think we're starting to lose Colton.
I was going to say, you guys are probably, he's just mad at me. I called him out and he got mad at me. Yeah. So
he'll get over it. He always does.
I'll be fine.
But we're going to,
I was using that for constructive criticism, right? Like,
no,
just an example.
No,
you're live on the show.
Oh,
call him out every time. The more people call him out, the more he needs that.
Devin's actually nice to me.
I'm nice to you too, in my own dadly way.
They're not.
Yeah.
They're not.
But no, you have to. I mean, that life isn't fair.
I call myself out.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be able to do that, and you have to be able to look at it and say, okay, well, that's the reality of it. You know, life isn't,
yeah,
not everybody in the world is going to be, and I'd rather somebody call me out than not tell me what it is that I really need to hear, because you're not going to get better simply by yourself. You need help from everybody. But yeah, no, I think we had a good show here today. I like this.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. I think there was some technical stuff in there. We touched on the Nationals. We talked about being able to dissect the races and how that's going to be helpful for not just somebody to beat Bryson, but just in general for other people. So I think that's something for everybody to take away.
Yeah. We might be on to something.
I try not to.
Might be.
Yeah, I try not to. Try not to sound like I'm a professional or something. Anything, because there's always better ways to do stuff. But anytime I can give out at least a piece of advice.
Well, you're the most professional one on the podcast right now, so we're all deferring to you. And you are the fastest one now. Nuh-uh. So I'm still the slowest. So you're not taking
Colton's
that away. Fred.
Colton's the fastest.
Yeah, if you ask him.
Yeah.
I don't know. You can come over. We'll race one day.
Yeah. We're gonna start doing that. I'm going to start taking you out to Devon and really let
good.
Him.
He's faster than you. I actually have someone to ride with.
Oh. Okay. All right.
Wow. Well, he just went. He went straight for the legs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm used to it by now. And then there's a lot to be said about knowing your limits, and I know my limits. So I'll take my lumps where I get them.
I'm just joking.
But yeah.
I think it was a good show.
Yeah.
You guys having me on again.
Yeah. We'll definitely try and keep doing this. I like it. And then we got to try and get Mike on here one day too and really get into the shock stuff, because I think that's something that's really beneficial for a lot of people. I think a lot of people know enough to be dangerous, but not enough to really take them to the next level. And I think Micah would really be able to expand on a lot of that stuff. So, still there? We still got you? Oh. All right, so I think we lost Devin. Maybe his phone died. Let's see if we can get him back on to finish the show up. But yeah, I thought it was a good. Yeah, I think we lost you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Sorry about that. I don't know what happened. At least we made it to the end of the show without any problems.
Yeah. So, we'll definitely keep trying to do this. If you're still game, I mean, it's nice having somebody else on here that has more experience and some more, a different way of looking at it. I think it's only better for the show. And I mean, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to put a better show out there and get more people listening and then grow the sport and go from there. So I had a good time. And yeah, that's all I got. So anything you want to add? Yeah. Anything you want to add in closing, Devin?
Nah, just, I appreciate you guys having me on again. It's always fun when I get to talk racing. So anytime I can do that, take advantage of it. And if anybody ever has any questions and I can help, I'm definitely here to do that. But again, I'm not by any means like the know all say all type person. So if there's something I can help with, definitely reach out and I'll try to do what I can. But I'm not the best either. So I'm not Walker or Adam or Bryson or somebody like that. But yeah. I might have a little bit of insight.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't necessarily have to be the best to be the best at something else. You know what I mean? You can't be the best at everything. The best racer might not necessarily be the best racing teacher or vice versa. So, you know, there's a lot to be said about that. So, yeah.
My dad always.
Go ahead.
My dad always told me those who can't do teach.
I'm a hell of a teacher.
That's why I started coaching.
But
I figure if I can't be the fastest, maybe I can teach somebody how to be
Hey, ain't no shame in that. But so yeah, that's going to be a wrap for episode 29. I'd like to thank everyone that helps make this possible. Definitely Custom Access and Micah, Quad Tech, Lone Star, Partzilla, for all your OEM parts. And let's see, Rebel Gears, Pro Graphics. If you're looking for graphics, they're still offering the discount on anyone that listens to the show. Just call Liz. She'll get you hooked up. GBC Tires, Renthal, Fast, O'Neill,
HMF.
I'm sure we're forgetting somebody, but
Chris, guys, Shoot, DP Brakes.
Yep. So until next time, thank you for spending your time with us. We greatly appreciate it. It means the world to us. If you found something in this episode that was beneficial, please feel free to share it and spread the word, because we appreciate it. And as we always say, make sure to keep it on four wheels.
Or three if you ride a three-wheeler.
All right, guys. We'll see you later. Thanks, Devin.
Yes, thank you.
All right, man.
Bye.